You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and please do follow this podcast on your platform of choice, including YouTube, where you'll also find loads of additional shorts and news insights. You can also subscribe and listen at www.freightbuyersclub.com. Today, we're looking at an air cargo market that, well, to say the very least, has had rather an unusual 2024, and a very positive one if you're selling cargo space rather than buying it. Joining me today are three people who pretty much have every air cargo base covered as we try and work out how we got here, what's driving all this, what happens in the Q4 peak season, and perhaps most pertinently, we'll explore why air freight is currently costing so much and what the supply-demand dynamics mean it might cost in future. So, to intros, my first of a panel of three today is Glyn Hughes, who many of you will know is the former IATA Global Head of Cargo. He's now the Director General of TIACA, the International Air Cargo Association. Welcome, Glyn.
Thank you, Mike. Welcome to you.
Next up is a returning favourite here to give us some operations expertise, particularly on that key Asian market. It's the VP for Global Sales and Marketing at Demerco Express Group. Cathy Lou, how are you doing today? Sorry, I didn't mean that to rhyme.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Cathy. Good to see you. And last but not least, we have Peyton Burnett, Managing Director of TAC Index, which is the air cargo calculating agent for... Well, Peyton, why don't you tell us?
Very good. for the Baltic Air Freight Index.
Baltic Air Freight Index. Is there more than one, Peyton?
It depends. There's a main index and there are other indices underneath that. So,
okay, perfect. We'll come back to those.
And they're indices rather than indexes.
It's that grammatical conundrum. Peyton, I'm going to start with you. Let's look at those prices on those major lanes that the Baltic covers. What's the market doing this month in September? And where are rates in relation to a year ago, particularly on those key outbound front haul legs from Asia into Europe and Asia into the US?
Sure. I mean, generally over the summer, it's been pretty strong throughout. I would say over the last couple of weeks, it's been a little bit weaker than expected. But just to give you an idea on year market rates, say outbound China to United States and to Europe, it's still up around the 25-30% mark. Some other markets to have a look at would be, say, India outbound to the United States, which is up 150% year on year, and India outbound to Europe is about 125% up year on year. And then lastly, a little bit of outbound from Vietnam to the US and Vietnam to Europe is just over 100% year on year increase.
Someone's making a bit of money then. Glyn, the latest numbers from IATA through July saw international demand up 14.3% compared to a year earlier. That was showing strong growth pretty much across all regions. Analysis from Rotate forecast demand growth of around 11 to 12% in 2024. What are TIACA members telling you about the strength of this demand? Have they been caught out at all?
Well, not so far, but I would actually say that what Peyton has just highlighted is reflective of what our members are saying. It's no surprise those markets are going up because that's where production is moving to. And if you look at India now, if you look at the fact that further production of Apple products is going to actually keep that steady progress going. Vietnam is benefiting significantly from China Plus One. So right now, the members are saying, in fact, it's buoyant optimism and the mood in general is very positive. It came up at an e-commerce event this week in Liège and it's coming through across our membership. But it is an eye to Q4, and I know we'll talk about Q4 in a little bit, but that's really where people are doing well now, but are aware of what's coming up.
Well, we will certainly go into why people are producing in some of those countries and that's why that's driving that demand as well a bit later in this podcast. Cathy, Isn't the summer supposed to be a downturn? What's this rather strong demand picture been looking like at load ports in Asia over the summer? A bit of a battle for space, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think recently those Southeast Asia countries, including India, they're really the demand. It's mainly bring up because of the China Plus One strategy. I think in recent years, we see a lot of production line move into those countries, especially like Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, and India. But the supply-wise, because of most of the carriers actually still move, let's say they don't really have that much direct capacity into US or Europe. Most of the airlines they are using actually still need to buy a certain hub, which also China is using. So we see there's very crowded in those gateway area, like in Tokyo, in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, and in Korea. So that's the imbalance on the supply, the demand, which is bringing the rates up a lot during this third quarter already.
Well, I'm going to come back to what that supply-demand balance means in Q4, which is the traditional peak season, and also into 2025 a little bit later. There's a lot of moving parts here. But before we do so, a more immediate issue, Glyn, maybe you can help with this. As of September, we've had a bunch of security warnings in Europe and North America. Some of this seems to be related to incendiary devices. Some of it's unsaid. Russia has been mentioned as a possible cause or instigator. Have you got any insight in terms of what impact this is having on supply chains, on your members, and anything more about what exactly this threat is from that customs and border authorities are referencing, but not really explaining?
Yeah, no, I think, and to be honest, Mike, you're doing a very good job because, of course, not a lot of information obviously gets circulated about situations other than to say that this industry will always continue to focus on safety and security as the number one priorities. So we have to make sure that we are vigilant, but most importantly, we're adaptive and responsive. So as governments see a change in the threat situation, they from time to time then will implement new procedures, new requirements, which then have an impact on the supply chain. What we've seen with that recent situation, as you mentioned, is a couple of things. We've seen Germany, for example, introduce land-based border checks within the Schengen area. So that means that some truck movements across some of the, and it's actually possibly going to further expand beyond throughout Europe. It means truck movements, which previously would go seamlessly, occasionally now are actually being subject to inspections. But more immediately is an emergency amendment that was adopted in the US, which actually enhanced or increased the amount of data that they now require for their ACAS advanced cargo filing system, which means that significant more information relating to each shipment is needed to be collected by the freight forwarder from the shipper to the carrier or whoever is making that filing. Some of this information is not readily at hand and not readily in a digital form. So it is actually causing some challenges. In terms of impact, some carriers have said that whilst there is this period of flux before the rules are 100% clarified and confirmed, they're actually embargoing cargo from certain countries to the US just to avoid getting caught up in this increased filing procedure. It's not a significant number of embargoes so far, but the TSA and CBP are actually engaging with the industry to provide an FAQ or an enhanced FAQ, and they're trying to issue information. But what they're saying is they felt that it was an important enough change not to delay implementation of the need for new data. So we certainly are watching it because, of course, that can have impacts again as we move into an even further peak. It's difficult to say peak period now because we've had double-digit growth for the year. So if we go into a peak period, it could get a little bit problematic.
What are the, do you know, have you got those names, the countries to hand, Glyn, in terms of who's embargoed?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to kind of highlight because, again, that situation is fluid. But the US has a reference and is a list. And I think it is available because the airlines obviously got information directly and they circulate it to their forwarder customers and others. But I think the list is somewhere in the range of about 50 odd countries where they're actually saying they want enhanced information from, which includes the EU and the UK, for example. So it is, again, it's a fluid situation. And again, we're just a few days after the 9/11 anniversary. So we're always reminded this industry has to keep focused and we have to respond, regardless of it may be challenging from an operational perspective.
One to watch for sure. As mentioned, we have some strong market drivers right now. Cathy, The big two, is this container ship Suez Canal diversions and e-commerce demand, or are other sectors, whether they're retailers or manufacturers, are other sectors driving this as well? And maybe us journalists are focusing too much on those big two. I'll throw one out there at you. I'm sure you guys have got a share of a semiconductor market. I'm sure that's doing okay, isn't it?
Yeah, right. The semiconductor industry actually runs quite well. And for the Q4, the fourth quarter, the peak season, what we have seen is that for the ocean freight, actually, it's already slowed down since September, end of August, because of, I think, the customers, they are more care about if there's any like a high ocean freight rates, high demand, and also they worry about the unreliable schedules offered during the traditional peak season. So we see this year they bring the peak season of ocean freight actually earlier. So that's why we see in June and July, the rates actually is growing up so fast. And now it's already slowed down and we don't see any sign that it will reach the very peak point again for the ocean freight. But for the air freight, the demand is still very strong, like semiconductors and like those new products introduction in the market start from end of September, beginning of October. And for sure, also, we see there's a lot of demand actually is driving by the e-commerce because of most of those promotions actually is during the fourth quarter for those big selling, we call selling festivals. So all those factors actually leading, we will see a very peak season start from end of September, especially after the Moon Festival, which is next week in China. And we will see the demand will pick up very quick all the way up to the beginning of December.
Okay, I'll come back to that in a sec, but I just want to go to Peyton and Glyn. These two big drivers, so let's call it Temu and Shein on one side, de facto closure of Suez on the other. Have you got any insights into how those two things are playing out differently on the Asia-Europe lanes versus Trans-Pacific lanes?
I'm happy to go first from just a market intelligence perspective and when I speak to our members and others. And Kathy, I fully agree with everything that she was saying there in the sense that, you know, we saw an earlier peak for maritime, also for the extended sailings as well, which meant that they just couldn't risk leaving it too late, which is good for air freight because had that been the case and we would have been seen with modal shift as well as it were, the two factors that you already talked about would have really been a perfect storm for air cargo and it would just been a complete blockage. But when you look at e-commerce, of course, and it's not just Temu Shein, but when you go to Hong Kong, and Peyton obviously is much closer to this than I am, it's about 80% of the cargo that's coming out of Hong Kong is e-commerce based. So you've got 20% of global volumes in totality, but it's obviously weighted differently. And Asia or China, particularly to Europe and to the US, Transpac, and through to Europe, it's a significant percentage of the volume that's going through there. So much so that with the projections of how that will grow even more over the next few weeks, sorry, as the shopping festivals season really kick off, we're already seeing that carriers are redeploying capacity from other markets because we said capacity is going to be a little bit tight. So we're seeing some withdrawn capacity off, for example, Latin America, Europe, Latin America, where rates are not quite so high, where imbalance exists a little bit in terms of trade flows, et cetera. So a lot more capacity is moving to the Asia, Europe, and Transpac trade lanes, for example. But again, it's still going to be a tight challenge for Q4.
You're expecting a capacity crunch there, are you?
I think we can certainly expect to see, and now we'll probably talk about rates a little bit later, but I don't think we'll see the levels that we saw during COVID because, of course, that was exceptional. But I think it would be realistic to anticipate that as capacity comes a little bit tighter, there's not a lot of new aircraft coming on stream now. There's not a lot of old aircraft that can be deferred from retirement. Some aircraft that have been parked, there's not enough time to get them back into service before, as it were, the Q4 crunch period. So I think that consequence will mean that rates go up. So we just hope that shippers secure that capacity they need early enough, work with their freight forwarders to try and smooth that out somewhat.
Kathy, Demerco is chartering its own capacity in response to all this demand. What routes are you running and what is that capacity and how's take up been?
So for the capacity wise, it's really, we see the very peak season will come in this year. And also we see like in the market that Temu and Shein actually already procured extra capacity, especially on the freighters. So what we see in the market is that like Temu, they already purchased the 90 freighters, scheduled freighters into US in this peak season. So means that the capacity will be for other commercial flights will be reduced. And the Shein actually, they occupied all the rest of FedEx freighters all the way up to the end of December. So we see the very less freighters will be available in the market, and which lead the supplier will be very limited compared with keep growing demand. So yeah, I think that's the trend for the capacity shortage, what we will see in the coming season.
As you mentioned before, we have had this early peak shipping season. One of the reasons that was concerns over Suez Canal diversions and future rates, but there has been the specter of another disruption hanging over the shipping market. And I think that possibly could play a role in air cargo markets. I'm interested to see what you think on that, at least. This is the ILA union, over 14,000 dock workers, which is threatening to bring US container trades via Gulf and East Coast ports to a halt at the start of October if port interests represented by USMX don't agree to their terms, quite substantial terms as well. This does increasingly look like it will happen. I've said that before, though, and these things sometimes just get resolved. Political intervention might be a factor here. But Cathy, firstly, is this a factor for you when you're speaking to customers? Are people concerned about this as they're looking at procuring Q4 air cargo capacity?
Yeah, sure. Definitely it will be impacted because the potential strike on the East Coast, actually they will impact on the ocean freight. So we already see more and more this kind of requirement that the customers switch the ocean freight into air in order to catch up the delivery date. And also that's what we also just realized that we take Shanghai as an example, that actually every week we only have 9 freighter schedules into flying to New York. But compared with like Chicago, weekly we have more than 30 freighter schedules into Chicago. So under this comparison, we see actually the air freight capacity into New York area to cover East Coast is very limited compared with the middle part. Under this kind of situation, we will see that if more customers switch ocean into air by moving into New York, there will be a big issue for them to see the capacity shortage. So I think the shippers better to plan their, let's say, their cargoes move by other gateway in US, especially like Chicago, which to cover the East Coast, it can be maybe this can be more capacity to support the shipment movement.
Peyton, I guess two things. Where are you expecting this mismatch between supply and demand to take rates this peak season? And I guess the other thing is, what happens to whatever your calculations are if we have this strike at US ports, this ILA dispute, when there's all these other disruptive factors hitting shipping? And we've also got a big hurricane season expected as well.
Sure, sure. I mean, even for SIPs, so I've just been in Hong Kong, and a lot of the guys are saying, you know, we've got the sort of product releases that are sort of people know ahead of time. But there are other wild cards, whether it's dock strikes or what I've also heard in the market is there's some big potential shipments to move solar panels from Southeast Asia and the likes. I think also what I've been told by both the carriers and forwarders is that for this year, there's been a lot more capacity pre-contracted, which is fine. But that also means there's not a lot of slack in the system to access spot rates. And so with any of these disruptions happening, there will be a significant spike in the pricing. I've heard that a lot of forwarders are sort of saying everything's fine. I've already booked my space. I'm okay. And some of the charter airlines are saying, now we understand that, but you might need to sit down. And if you want to do an extra charter from China to South America, it's going to cost you $2 million. Obviously, the forwarder is saying, oh, I'm not paying that price. But at the end of the day, you might have no choice. So that's a bit scary that this is what's lingering in the system if there is more of a capacity crunch and you haven't secured your access to capacity.
Yeah, a very taut market. The ILA dispute, as I mentioned before, I mean, I only really see a resolution there with government intervention. Come to the elections in a moment. But Glyn, are you hearing anything different on any of this? I mean, this is going to put a lot of pressure on the air freight business to and from the US.
It is, Mike. And in fact, there's another factor as well here, because of course, the West Coast ports are at a high level of congestion. So it's not really an alternative. If you've closed East Coast, thankfully, Panama Canal is back to normal or more consistent levels of higher volume transits per day, for example. But we could end up with a situation as we had when the West Coast ports were on strike, where you got ships moored out at sea for 3-6 weeks or sometimes longer. So without an alternative to go through the West Coast, the other factor that you have to bring into here is when the West Coast port strike happened, the Transpac is a freighter market. So there were already freighters on that route that did have surplus capacity at that time. So they were able to absorb, rates still went up quite significantly, but they were able to absorb some of the more crucial. Remember, there were consignment, I think McDonald's ran out of French fries, so they had to air freight in, you know, freighters worth of potatoes, for example. But right now, the situation with the demand that's being absorbed by e-commerce, with the traditional customers who are also having a good year, those customers need to be serviced. Anything happens to East Coast means they could be third in queue to try and get capacity, which is going to be difficult to find. And don't look at the belly capacity going transatlantic is not going to be a way of means helping. And as Kathy highlighted, Transpac to get to New York, there isn't just that additional capacity to go through. So I think that could have a severe impact on trade, as it were.
Just a note to listeners there on some of those points that Glyn raised. A year ago, we had the ILWU union resolved its dispute with port and shipping interests on the US West Coast port. But in the run-up to that resolution, we saw this drift of cargo to the East Coast, which saw the East Coast actually get the majority of that cargo. We mentioned the early peak season this year. What we've seen in that early peak season is a drift back to the West Coast. So that buildup in cargo is very, very logical. People were just routing that way because it reduces their risk. But we are seeing congestion build up at the port, but also on the intermodal element of and the drayage in terms of that domestic market and getting your cargo to wherever you need to reach in the States. It feels like there's so many moving parts to try and run through. We've just had the presidential debate. Trump doubled down on his economic argument that higher tariffs hurt China, not US consumers. And he said he'll increase them. Now he's talking about 100%. Before it was 60 or 65. That's on imports from China. If any of this happens, it's hard to not think that it leads to more trade wars. Democratic candidate Harris, she didn't really row back on anything that Trump implemented in his first administration or that Biden's added to in terms of tariff policy over his administration. So she's talking about more targeted tariffs on China. Glyn, so how are your US or your Chinese members viewing any of this?
Well, I have to be honest, Mike, I'm a globalist, and I think that free market economics should really be the prevailing factor when it comes to trade, and that any time a government tries to insert itself in what is a free market decision or free-flowing process, nobody wins. And it's not as if we have to go back very far in history to anticipate what's going to happen next. We know, as you say, it's both administrations will be looking at trade tariffs and et cetera, because it is an idea or it's a notion which resonates well with the US electorate. But when you lift the lid, and let's just go back to 2019, when Trump won, was around, and the first round of what a US-China trade war could look like from tariffs. And I'm just going to focus on one thing, which was a consequence of that, Harley-Davidson. China immediately said, you know, China is Harley-Davidson's number one overseas market. So China introduced a 25% tariff on US-made motorcycles. Harley-Davidson looked at that and said, we only have one decision. We have to manufacture in China. So they actually moved and set up a joint venture with a Chinese company, and now they produce the bikes there. So would you say that the American economy benefited from the consequences of that? No, and my concern would be that anything happens. We know EV vehicles are coming in for 100%. And this is also Europe is tackling it as well because the perceived inequality of production costs, et cetera. Solar panels, Peyton mentioned solar panels. They're also coming in for increased tariffs right now, et cetera. So I think the concern would be that the first salvo is not the end. It then becomes a tit for tat scenario. We do also anticipate the US, probably both administrations, looking at the de minimis, which currently stands at $800 in the US, which by global standards is quite considerably higher than almost every other market. And that even that in itself, and sorry, I don't like to stray into politics, but if you look at, there is an act right now going through the US, and it's titled the End China Basically Taking Advantage or of the De Minimis Act, which is not the case at all. It's really the US consumers are benefiting from being able to buy products overseas, and they have a high threshold of which they can bring them in without paying any additional duties and tariffs on them. But if that were to lower, I don't think it would have a significant impact, because as has actually been discussed this last week, cargo may then need to take a different routing. We saw that imports into Mexico have seen a huge boost, and I follow the TAC index there, which kind of indicates that you can see what's happening to trade by following what's happening with the rates. Cargo will find new routes, but it also will then get retaliatory measures, which I don't think anybody will win.
Yeah, I mean, Nomura did put out a note. I mean, it's very difficult to separate politics and trade at the moment. The note said, and I'll quote, many Chinese exporters have discovered multiple ways to circumvent additional US tariffs that were imposed by the first Trump administration. We've covered tariff avoidance on this podcast before. You've mentioned there India has benefited from some of this. Vietnam and Mexico are also seen huge trade bumps even this year, but in previous years too. If we have higher tariffs, we'll just see more of this, won't we?
I can add something here, Mike. Yeah, the other thing just with the e-commerce guys is that they're very aware of these tariffs coming in with EU and US. And actually, they've been quite actively trying to start up new markets or actively pushing into South America, actively pushing into Africa. Just around the region here, we have Temu's made a big push into Thailand and Vietnam or around this region per se. And I can say the Thai government is very concerned about Temu's push into Thailand and disrupting the local e-commerce people. So they're now saying it's just a concern. And how do we counter this big giant Temu moving into the Thai market? Another thing just to be aware of, I know that you were talking more about US elections. I'm over here in Thailand, and I know that, you know, there's been this sort of China plus one, China plus two policy with people moving manufacturing bases into Southeast Asia and the Indian region. But there are other political issues here. I would say Thailand is looking maybe a little bit wobbly for next year with we just had the new lady prime minister come in, but then she booted out the military and they might not like that. So I've been through Thailand through one coup, and then I moved down to Phuket. So I might be booking something on Airbnb next year. So let's see how it goes.
That very British understatement, might not like that, might not like that. I think history tells us you might well be right on that point. Kathy, is there anything you want to add here?
Yeah, I think for the election result, it's also concerns of a lot of those Chinese manufacturers, because they all worry about the new president on board will bring up more tariff. So there's, I think, another reason bring up the cargo volume, cargo demand in this fourth quarter, because everybody like to move out all the inventory to US already before the new president be elected. But for talk about if there's still any potential tariffs will be implemented, I think just like Glenn mentioned, there's nobody will be the winner for that, actually. But this kind of thing will push actually the Chinese manufacturers to go global. So in the past, they all, let's say, all set up only in China. But now we see more and more going to like automotive. They go to Thailand and they go to Mexico. But by the end, still Chinese manufacturers, they are produced there and then selling back to US. So this is something like the end user or the end consumers actually need to bear all those extra costs. That's what we see first thing. And the second thing is that like the iPhone story, they move out to India, but actually they move back recent months, just because of the quality in India is not really can match Apple standards. So just the recent 3 months, they moved back to production line for the iPhone 16. So by the end, still it's made in China and then move to US market. So we see this kind of, let's say, up and down. It's also not really a benefit to the manufacturers or those US or Europe companies. Actually, there's a lot of, let's say, extra cost be created during this kind of geopolitical environment. So yeah, let's see. But I think it's somehow encourage more Chinese company go globalization, which is good. And another thing is that I think all the other countries need to be prepared for the, let's say, supply chain management because of, you know, the supply chain built up in China actually is already over maybe 4 decades. So the Chinese government invest a lot to build up the full supply chain, especially for electronics or for automotive and for semiconductors. And if any other country like to replace this kind of matured supply chain, for sure it takes time.
And I guess those challenges are different in different places. India's had a problem with bureaucracy and infrastructure, and they need to invest in that. I mean, Mexico's had these big numbers on the trade front, but its FDI numbers aren't great. There's a mismatch there. Do you see any of these issues with where you're working with Demerco, Kathy?
Yeah, I think for India, it's also, if we talk about international transportation, the India market is still, it's like they have very limited capacity for air freight, especially in and out India. There's only few carriers that are running regular freighter service into India. So this is something, the challenge for the international part. And for the domestic part, for sure, it's the infrastructure of India. It's not that in good condition. So the lead time for the domestic trucking is also another concern. And also, especially for the custom brokerage, custom related issues, they are all very newly set up as like an international hub or international gateway. So that's the challenge we see. And that's also how we invest our team over there to be trained to offer professional service for the, especially for customs related. And also we have our Chinese colleagues over there, which can help on the language wise to communicate with other countries. And for Mexico, I think it's very similar situation because there's also very few carriers running freighter into Mexico directly. So most of the time, we actually use still the U.S. gateway for the international part and the connect with the truck into Mexico directly in and out. So those are, I think, those infrastructure and also the carrier strategy-wise, those both countries will face the challenge in the coming future.
Mike, can I just add an extra thing to what Kathy was saying there about India as well? We know that the government obviously has a very well-stated and well-articulated objective or vision to turn the economy into a $5 trillion economy, moving 10 million tons of air cargo every year. But as Kathy mentioned, most of the freighters that are right now serving India are foreign registered freighters, which means they are subject to the policies and the demands of those carriers not based in India. So if they see greater demand and greater potential and revenue opportunities elsewhere, they will move them. And I think that Boeing did a study which highlighted that if India truly wants to achieve this objective, then it's woefully short in flag registered freighters, which then have, as it were, a stronger demand or stronger inclination to serve the India market inbound, outbound. So I think that's one of the challenges that India is going to face as they hope to benefit more. Now there are production challenges, as both Peyton and Kathy have talked about, but going forward, that is one of the challenges that they will also have to address.
I wonder if Boeing wouldn't mind some people in India buying some Boeing freighters. That was my
I can tell you they've had a number of meetings there in terms of highlighting the, and their statistics are, if you just look at the number of flag-registered freighters, it's, I believe, less than a dozen or less than 15. And for a country with that population, just compared to how many in China, for example, or the US or other markets.
We'll just take a short break. We'll be back with you in a second.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
These emerging air freight markets, I've been going to air cargo conferences for a couple of decades. You've got TIAA's air cargo forum actually takes place just after the elections, which are on the 5th of November. Your air cargo forum is in Miami, 11th to the 14th of November. When I go to these conferences, we always talk about the slowness. It sounds ridiculous, but especially if you're not in air freight, it sounds ridiculous, but the slowness of air cargo supply chains, the end-to-end process takes way longer than the flight. Essentially, if I'm simplifying, that's when China's made all these investments in making sure its end of that supply chain has been super efficient. As we've just heard there, emerging markets don't have that investment. How does that affect that conversation, Glyn?
I mean, it's a fascinating topic because, you know, and forgive me for saying this, but an IATA study, I think it was about 45, 50 years ago, so even before I joined the industry, said that cargo took on average 6.25 days to move from not airport to airport, but from, as it were, consignor to consignee. And then 20 years later, that had come down to like 5.9. But the planes fly as fast as they can fly, utilization, optimization, things of that nature. So it really comes down to what happens on the ground and what happens at the border. And as you've already mentioned at the beginning or earlier about the complexity of security filings and pre-clearance, et cetera. But there are some really wonderful examples. I mean, if you look at the perishables market, if you look at the flowers that come out of Kenya that fly into the European airports, they're pre-cleared and they're almost off the airport. The first flowers that are offloaded are almost off the airport before the rest of the plane is fully offloaded. So this industry can do it, but it requires all entities, because if a customs officer somewhere says, I know I've got all the information digitally, but I want to see a piece of paper with a signature, you know, that can hold up things 24, 36, 48 hours. Even the early part of if somebody's got a particularly large shipment and forwarded trying to get rates from carriers, that can actually lose a day in just trying to procure the actual, you know, rate and then with the space. So we need to digitalize much more the interactive process up front. You know, it's the same as when if you look on the passenger side, and I always used to threaten my kids that we would go on holiday like a piece of cargo. And they said, oh, how's that, Daddy? And I says, well, it takes us 6 days to go from the house to the hotel. We stay one day there, then it's 6 days to come home again. You know, it's just inconceivable. As passengers, we like to go online, book our ticket. We're in control of the procedure at the airport. We know what we need to do to comply. We prepare ourselves in advance, and then we get on, we get off, and we move through. So we can do a lot more in cargo, but I have to say the innovation that we've seen post-COVID from the technology sector is tremendous. I think we've probably moved forward 10 years. Now we just need the entire community to embrace and interact with each other to a much higher degree. But I'm confident that we're going to overcome that challenge, particularly as e-commerce customers. And I had this discussion, sorry for going a slight different direction here. People were saying the other day, e-commerce customers are getting, as it were, unrealistically demanding for faster. And my position is actually the opposite. E-commerce is replacing physical commerce. Physical commerce, the emotional side of physical commerce is I would go into a store, I would pay for something and take ownership 15 seconds later when I leave the store. That's what we're trying to compare to. So when we tell people, oh, you're going to have to wait 3 days, 4 days for us. So they're not being unrealistic to want quicker. They're actually saying, but I used to get it in 15 seconds. Now, we're obviously never going to be able to compete with that. But the emotional side means we have to understand that e-commerce is about the purchase and ownership transaction. That's the biggest difference, has occurred before transport in most cases. Old days, we were moving 10-ton consignments into retail outlets. If it got there in 5 days, 8 days, 10 days, doesn't matter, as long as it was in the store when somebody came in to buy it. So it was a different procurement process.
What I heard in the market, I think a big stick helps. So I heard with these e-commerce guys have very tough contractual obligations that they require from the carrier. So, you know, if you're 24 hours late or 48 hours late or a bit longer, then they're really large penalty clauses that take effect. I think that helps focuses people's minds when you suddenly get... I'm not sure. I've been out of this charter market for a while, But I heard stuff that if you're on time, fine. If you're a day late, you have to pay like 50%, then it's 100%, and then it's 200% of the charter price. I mean, it's really tough. And so some of these guys have quite a lot of fear actually taking on these contracts, especially if you're using maybe a carrier that's not so reliable. can get a bit hairy. But that's what I've heard in the market. And I think that, again, that's helped make cargo move quicker. And they're the guys controlling the business.
Cathy, you buy space. What would help your business? What would help you provide air cargo solutions faster? What could some of your suppliers provide to you to help you do that?
I think for us, we are actually just like this peak season, we block the charter. So we have the charter service on a weekly basis from Shanghai to Chicago because of the peak season demand. So I think this kind of arrangement can help our customer to move faster. And also another fact is that just like Peter mentioned, that actually e-commerce customers, they require very high penalty if you delayed. They have agreed transit time. If you delay one day, then there's deduct 5% of the freight charge, and then it will accumulate. So that's why a lot of those freight forwarders, if they are dealing with e-commerce, the e-commerce always will be at the priority list to get the capacity, especially during the peak season. But for us, what we are doing here, that we are not really handle e-commerce customers. So for all those, let's say, normal customers, because we are more focused for the electronic and the semiconductors, they can get 100% support from the from us about their capacity during the peak season, because we don't have the burden to deal with e-commerce with to afford those penalties. Yeah, so I think that's something different from our side to secure the capacity for our customers during the peak season to moving faster.
Glenn, Donald Trump's promise to end the war in Ukraine, presumably this opens up Russian airspace. Does this solve air freight's problems?
I was going to say only if I put my tooth under a pillow and I get a pound in return. you know, I think we have to look and say that it's almost impossible to actually even comment on that, Mike, because the scenario that he comes in, he makes one phone call, or that anybody, I don't want to focus on one, the likelihood of one person coming in and making one phone call and resolving that situation it's almost impossible to even conceive. And then the actual time frame it would take to then remove sanctions, because there's two things. There's the war and there's the sanctions. You know, the Russian closed airspace was not because of the war. It was because of the sanctions that were introduced as a result of the war. So unless the sanctions are actually removed, I see no reason why Russia would reopen the airspace to those carriers registered in countries which have actually emplaced sanctions. So unless Trump is actually then going to ring every member of the EU and say, I want you to actually release the bank funds that are being held, I want you to release the oligarchs' yachts that are actually being held, you know, then the airspace is not going to open. So sad as it is, that airspace is going to remain closed, as I say, because it's not necessarily directly linked to withdrawal of troops.
That brings me quite nicely on to 2025. I just want to look at some of these supply-demand fundamentals. I mentioned earlier, we've had 11 to 12% growth in demand this year. Rotate predicts 2 to 7% increase again in demand next year. On the supply side, the latest I had from Rotate was freighter fleets currently operating, 15 block hours per day. And we're looking at deliveries and conversions set to add a maximum of 4.4% of the fleet over the next year or so. Those maths aren't really adding up in terms of providing reliable and affordable services to me. I don't know, Glenn, thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, first of all, it has to be said that was a fascinating presentation, because the utilization, you know, the aircraft, and it was focusing on the 777, the 74-8, 74-400, for example. This is almost at peak utilization that the manufacturers say. So there's no flex built into the system. We saw these levels of utilization in short bursts during COVID, moving PPE around. So the fact that they've been doing this now operationally for most of this year does bring into itself, or they also need some time to breathe, as it were, and to do certain maintenance checks, et cetera. So I know they're going to be factored in. To your point, the retirements there, I don't think they factored in any retirements. There's probably, you know, any retirements that were scheduled. I know FedEx and UPS had a few MD-11s, for example, that they had already started to retire. I think others you might see deferments around the world, et cetera. I'm hearing that people are looking for perhaps some 747-400s that haven't necessarily been fully retired, but have been parked. Price of fuel is relatively low still at the moment and affordable. So as we see, and as we can anticipate rates going up, it does mean that you will possibly see some of the older aircraft that we had thought had would not seen might come back into operation, just to try and alleviate some of this capacity supply demand gap that we can anticipate going through. We should also point out to your readers that 2-7, whatever it is for next year, it's not necessarily a slowing market. It's just that the algorithm, the mathematical percentages, when you start comparing to this year where we had double digits, then of course it's still going to be good growth, but the number will look lower just because it's being compared to already a very high month in this year.
Peyton, so if I'm buying space for next year, then looking at those numbers, I don't know, what would you suggest? I've got to be looking beyond this peak season. I'm looking at higher freight rates next year, surely. Should I be buying space early? Maybe I should be hedging my risk?
I have no idea what's happening next year. A bit like Fez, air cargo, I've been in this industry long enough. I've got no idea what's going to happen. A bit like you said earlier, follow the rates. I would follow the money. My understanding, I think you guys are aware with Atlas, they are now owned by, is it Apollo Group? And I think their idea is to make Atlas greater. My understanding is that I think they've done the acquisition of 10 more wide-body freighters. So, you know, they're putting the money down. So I think they've been very bullish on the market going forward. A bit like Ben said, there's just no new supply coming on the market over the next year or two. We also had before these 777 conversions that were meant to happen in Israel, which isn't a great place today to do these conversions. I also heard that there might be a slight wind down with those sort of Boeing 767s as well. So, because I get asked a question from the pilots who fly these planes and say, well, what aircraft type should I be flying? So I've heard stick to wide bodies. So if that's any indication, you know, the other thing I heard from the bankers out in Hong Kong, they were all quiet. They're bullish on e-commerce and they're bullish on AI. They just say this e-commerce stuff's here to stay and it's not really going anywhere. And also the items that are being sold are more the lower side of the market and you're just cutting out the middleman. You might as well just get it delivered directly from China to your door. Well, why go through a retail outlet in London or New York? I'd just rather buy it online. Thanks.
I've got a theory I'm going to throw out there, looking at those fundamental numbers. Because if you're selling air freight space, they all look totally solid. You're looking at a great 2025. But there are things that could affect that. So peace in the Middle East. So just for listeners, the multiple between the cost of shipping and air freight, it would maybe be about 10 or 11 normally. So air freight would cost 10 or 11 times more than sea freight. At the moment, it's round about 4 on head hauls as a rule of thumb. If there was peace in the Middle East and the Suez Canal open, that flips back and that favours shipping a bit more. Also, it speeds transit times up, which is helpful for a lot of shippers. Glenn, you mentioned the de minimis exemption in the US. This allows e-commerce companies such as Temu Machine to fly cheap products straight to consumers, but this is under threat. This could be rescinded or changed in some way. And there's also calls on changes in the EU as well. If those two big drivers we set up at the start, the what's going on in the Middle East and e-commerce demand as it is now, if they were taken out of the equation, are we looking at a house of cards? Glenn, to you first.
A great question. And again, it would be a foolish man to actually say absolutely not, because one thing that's taught us is this industry, logistics, is you can only predict as far forward as next week. And even then, it's a risk. Just look at our hairstyles, Mike. Three of us, 75% on this. This is the stress that this industry has caused. So congratulations, Kathy, for keeping it. But it seems to have struck us pretty poorly. But to your point, Mike, now let's first of all look at the Red Sea. The maritime industry prior to November, they were in the tank. Then the Red Sea crisis happened. The 2-week extra sailings took place. Surcharges came in. Profits returned. Now you have a situation of additional capacity on the maritime sector because they've had to factor in the longer sailing times. They've had to invest in more containers because the container global fleet, there was a shortage of containers, etc. If you end up with a situation of the Red Sea opening again, it's actually not so good as well for the maritime sector. So, and then it adds to port congestion because you've got ships that are coming through the Red Sea into Europe. Oh, by the way, all the others that were going around the Cape, they're also going to be coming into Europe at the same time that left 2 weeks earlier. So now you've got other congestion issues. You've now, what are you going to do with the sailings? Are we going to see ships taken out of service, decommissioned, that could even be only maybe 5 years old? So the sad thing is that sometimes conflict and complexity, when we live with it, becomes normality. And that's kind of what we've got right now with the Red Sea. Now, we do hope from a humanitarian perspective, the Middle East crisis does resolve itself for the benefit of everybody and mankind, but it will require some period of flux to get normality to return back to that equation.
Kathy, the obvious question I've got to ask is, are you tearing your hair out thinking about 2025?
I think for 2025, just like they mentioned, actually, if the Red Sea crisis still moving forward, actually, it's benefit to the shipping liners. I think just like recently that the potential strike on East Coast, actually, the shipping liners also somehow looking forward to that because that's the how they can push up the ocean freight rates. And for the 2025, I guess those kind of geopolitics issues will be still there. But if we are looking to the real demand, we see that something potentially will impact on the demand is that for talk back to the e-commerce, which is the biggest support to the air freight now. But just like Peyton mentioned, for especially for like a Temu, actually the value of the cargo is very low. Sometimes even lower than the freight they are paying, but they are actually running free of the shipping charges to the end consumers. This kind of model cannot last longer. So what we see, they already start to establish the warehouse, the inventory, or let's say the DC in US. So after the DC be completed, for most of the cargo of Temu, we believe it will be moved by ocean freight instead of the air freight. Then this can be something impact. But the good news is we talk about AI because of the recent new model of those consumer electronics. They all insert AI function. So this is completely new generation compared with before. So it will bring up another round of the change on those equipment like laptops, cell phones in the market. So especially start from end of this year and throughout next year. So this is somehow can bring up the demand especially for the air freight market. That's what we see. Yeah.
Yeah. Just following on from what Kathy was saying, I do know that the leasing companies are very much monitoring those changes with the e-commerce companies moving to putting their warehouses closer to the customer. And so they're very interested in seeing that change take effect because it could mean that there'll be a higher demand for narrow body freighters rather than wide body freighters. So this is something that they're actively monitoring at the moment. So I was just saying I concur with Kathy.
Yeah. And Mike, can I just make one additional comment there? Because I think Kathy's right that if, you know, Temu, the cost of customer acquisition, they spent $2 billion on Google Ads last year because they're spending a fortune on acquiring the customer for that data for their next move. You know, we don't know how they're going to evolve as a business. But the crucial thing I look at is if we'd had this podcast in 2019, we wouldn't even mention Temu and Shein. And yet today, they're accounting for about 75 freighters a day. You know, can you imagine what will happen then next? So if those models change, the Amazon model's evolving, others will spring up. There will be new directions for e-commerce because e-commerce is a phenomenon. It's a change of consumer behavior. It's about how people value their time and how they value the retail experience and how they acquire things. So that's actually going to evolve. So as companies in it evolve, others will evolve and that will spring up that we don't even know exist.
Certainly a lot to consider. Let's finish on something positive, and thanks for all bearing with me. Sustainable aviation fuel. Obviously, it's currently too expensive. It's not being used much or enough. and not enough is being produced. It's all a bit of chicken and egg. Shippers say they want it, though. Glyn, what needs to happen to turn this around? Give me some optimism, please.
Right. Well, first of all, every bit that's being produced is being used. There is, as soon as a carrier acquires an arrangement for X amount of tons, etc., it's almost immediately secured. We also have to acknowledge that the air cargo industry, in particular the shipper demand for SAF, is actually leading the way here, because as the procurement process is occurring, the shippers are working with their forwarders and the carriers to try and secure as much as they can to offset and to have more environmentally friendly supply chains. It's currently, I think this year it's projected to be about 1% of total fuel demand is going to be satisfied with SAF. And when you think that by 2050, the IATA projection is that 65% of the net zero objective is going to come through SAF. So how do we get from 1% to that volume? It's a very clear pathway in the sense that we need investment from the private sector, investment from governments. That 3x price is also a consequence of lack of economies of scale. You can't produce 1% of anything at the same price point as you produce the other 99%, for example. So there's a lot of feedstock. There's over 100 different pathways to take what there is existing in the world, whether or not it's vegetation, bio cooking oil, for example, or other waste materials, and turn it into SAF. Some of them are uneconomic, so therefore they will be discarded, but some of them are very economic. The technology exists, but the technology is not right now in the place where the feedstock is. There needs to be more technology available for Africa, because it's got a lot of agricultural byproducts that could be used there and in Central Asia. You don't want to have to sell the feedstock from there, move it to Europe where the technology is, or the US, and then sell or send the fuel back. So, you know, there needs to be a lot more focus on the investment, a lot more government incentives. The US, I think they called it the Inflation Reduction Act, then awarded a tax credit for every manufacturer, for every gallon of SAF they produced. Very creative. I think other measures need to be used. There's incentives in UK, for example, for investment in this area. The EU, which was falling behind in green energy and green technology, they need to catch up with the US and China in terms of research and investment. So it's positive, but it's going to require a lot of struggle.
So we need transformational investment levels and policy direction. Peyton, is some of these SAF targets in terms of usage, would you bet on them being hit? Or I don't know, just another idea. Maybe you could do an index on it or something, but index on SAF pricing or
uptake. Hey, I know we get
that's actually a good idea.
No, well, we have been asked to do jet fuel price indices and the likes, but we're so inundated with other stuff. Now we stuck that on the back burner.
I think we probably need to do a full podcast on this, but let's finish on something positive. Kathy, you guys at Demerco recently partnered with Cathay Cargo and ASA on SAF. What's the deal and what are you hoping to achieve?
I think we joined the SAF program with Cathay since last year. And I think it's a part of our commitment to the, let's say, the sustainability and reduce the environment impact of the logistics. So we joined this program and our target is to also to help our customers can leverage this kind of resources to reach their sustainability goals. So that's something we are working together with Cathay. And I think we recently signed it with Acer, and also other customers already joined this program with us. And we reached together the sustainability goals, actually.
Nice to finish on something positive amid all this geopolitical strife. Cathy Liu, Vice President, Global Sales and Marketing at Demerco Express Group. Glyn Hughes, Director General of TIAKA. And Peyton Burnett, MD of TAC Index. Thanks so much, all of you, for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mike.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the Demerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice, or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.